Hello, everyone, and welcome to this special edition of Employment Matters, brought to you by the Employment Law Alliance, the world's largest network of labor and employment lawyers from the best law firms around the globe. I'm your host today, Susan Deniker. Along with bringing you updates and critical events happening around the world, we are also fortunate to have the chance to dial in our local ELA lawyers that practice on the ground in these jurisdictions and are working daily to help our local clients move through these difficult times. On the program, we span the globe, and we have received updates on critical issues from ELA members in each region. Today, we are going to be chatting with a member from New York and a member from Maryland. Joining us today on the program is Pete Jones, member at Bond, Shenick & King in upstate New York, and Mark Swordland, partner at Shaw Rosenthal LLP in Baltimore, Maryland. We're so excited to have both of these gentlemen with us today, and they have a really important topic to discuss to provide us with updates on NLRB developments impacting higher education. Welcome to the program, Pete and Mark. How are you both doing today?
Doing very well, Susan. Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yes, Susan, happy to participate and glad to talk to you both today about these topics.
Well, it's great to be with both of you. So, like you guys, I follow higher ed law very closely and practice in this area, and we just got a big development from the NLRB that I know we want to be talking to our clients about. So, Mark, talk to us a little bit about what the NLRB just did when it recently withdrew proposed rulemaking that would have exempted from the NLRB's jurisdiction undergraduate and graduate students who perform services for financial compensation in connection with their studies. That was a proposed rule under the Trump administration. What does this mean for unions interested in organizing these students?
Thanks, Susan. So this topic has been really interesting for the past 20 years or so at the Labor Board. And I'm not sure how many of our listeners have been following this, but the board has changed its position three times since 2000. So in 2000, there was a decision involving New York University, and that was a case where the board approved for the first time the ability of grad assistants to unionize. Then in 2004, involving Brown University, the board reversed itself and there decided that student teachers did not count as employees because the relationship between the school with those student teachers focused mainly on education, not so much a financial relationship. Then again, we go back to a reversal. So in 2016 at Columbia University, the board under the Obama administration decided that graduate assistants were to be considered employees and could vote on union representation. So that takes us to 2019, when the board under the Trump administration issued the rulemaking that would have exempted from board jurisdiction the undergraduate and graduate students who perform services for financial compensation in connection with their studies. And according to the rulemaking at that time, back in 2019, the reason was that, according to the board, the relationship that these students had with the schools was predominantly educational rather than economic. Then just in March of this year, March 15th, the board withdrew the rulemaking. And according to the short notice that was published in the Federal Register, the reason was that the board determined that to focus its time and resources on the adjudication of cases currently in progress as opposed to rulemaking. So what does this mean? Well, it means that for right now, the law stands as with it does with the Columbia University case, the 2016 case, which is where the board found that graduate assistants, as I mentioned, could vote for union organization. So the playing field is open again for unions to try to organize among these groups. And before we hear from Pete and some of his thoughts, I'd just like to share with the audience that what's interesting in this past year, and the rulemaking came into place, but obviously had not become an official rule. There were some successful efforts at universities, and we're talking private, not public, because the public universities are not governed by the labor board. So grad students were successful in union elections at American University, Brown, Georgetown, and Harvard. And it's interesting about that is it really kind of doubled the numbers of private schools that had had a union among graduate students in this limited category. So there had been a lot of activity just recently, which I think after the board issued the rulemaking, there was a suspicion that it would quickly dry up, of course.
Mark, let me follow up just briefly with you on that before Pete jumps in. And as a result of the withdrawal of this proposed rulemaking, we've already seen some noise being made from unions and from graduate student groups that are looking to unionize. What should colleges and universities expect now in light of this change?
Yeah, Susan, I think that, again, private universities and colleges should expect there to be activity in this area. From what I've seen over the years in this group, and I also work a lot with public universities. So while they're not governed by the labor board, they're governed by the various state, you know, labor laws. And so some of that experience is of interest to me, too, in terms of what I see in this area. And I continue to see the higher educational landscape as being a fertile ground for unions to organize in. And I do believe that in the private universities that are still governed by the labor board, that you should expect to see a lot of activity in the schools that don't already have units among their graduate student assistants and teachers.
I think that those are really important points. Pete, I know you have some thoughts on this too. I'd like for you to share that with our audience.
Yes, thank you, Susan. So just a couple of quick thoughts. I mean, one of the things that I think we probably want to just comment on is that there's an interesting dynamic at play here that we have seen in other areas involving the NLRB as well. And that is kind of the board going back and forth between differing positions depending upon the president who is appointing the majority of the board. And so you've got typically a 3-2 majority based upon whoever sits in the White House. And the decisions tend to, in many areas, and this is one of them, go back and forth. So when Mark mentions NYU to Brown to Columbia and then the proposed rulemaking, we're kind of seeing the pendulum shift back and forth. At the crux of the question is whether this is an economic relationship or primarily an institutional student relationship that involves elements of financial aid and learning. And those are the rationales that we see in these flip-flopping decisions. You know, on the one hand, if it's primarily an economic relationship, it might lend itself to collective bargaining. At least that's what NYU and Columbia, those decisions have said. On the other hand, you've got Brown and frankly, as far back as Stanford University back in the 70s, the board saying, no, it's primarily a student institution relationship. There are some financial elements to it, but because it's a student relationship, it ought to be removed from the ambit of collective bargaining. So my takeaway, I think it's similar to the two of you, is that, you know, we're going to see more organizing activity, but we're also going to see the results of that organizing activity, potentially strikes if you cannot work out the collective bargaining relationship. And, you know, right now we're seeing that at Columbia, that we've got, you know, graduate students who have engaged in job actions to try to exercise their economic leverage in the context of collective bargaining. And so that's a challenge, I think, for institutions when they are in bargaining in that kind of an environment, because, you know, the disruption that could be caused at a large institution where there's a lot of graduate students who are engaged in teaching, instruction, grading, things of that nature, can be pretty significant.
Pete, thanks for those observations. Let me stay with you for a minute because I want to switch gears here. We talked a little bit about organizing of students and graduate students. Let's talk about what's going on in terms of organizing with regard to non-tenure track faculty members. There's a recent case that's just come down from the board involving Elon University. Tell us now what test the board is using for non-tenured faculty members and that group of employees.
Yeah, it is a very interesting area. So I think it probably bears starting with a couple of baseline principles in order to get into a productive discussion of the Elon case. Supervisors are statutorily excluded from organizing under the National Labor Relations Act. Managers have also been excluded under longstanding case law. There's a Bell Aerospace case that the Supreme Court decided. And the theory here really is that if you're going to have collective bargaining, you need to have two parties to sit at the bargaining table. And therefore, if employees can organize, there needs to be someone who's on the management side in order for collective bargaining to work. I think in the higher education context, this concept has proven more difficult to implement. Much like on the student question that we just spoke of, it's been hard to determine who those managers are. And it starts back with the Yeshiva case in 1980, where the Supreme Court ruled that faculty who engage in shared governance to a sufficient degree would be managers and ineligible to organize under the National Labor Relations Act. And since that time, in the intervening 30 now plus years, I think the NLRB and institutions have really struggled with what it means to be a manager and to be excluded as a faculty member from the ambit of the National Labor Relations Act. So what happened in the Elon case is that the board revisited an issue of how they are going to implement the yeshiva criteria to determine who's management. And in that case, just to shed a little light on it, the petition sought to represent all non-tenure track, that is visiting limited term faculty members, excluding the tenure track and those with continuous appointments. So people with a more tenuous connection to the shared governance mechanism at Elon. And over the years, the board had developed a test that basically said, if the faculty don't constitute a majority of the committee in question that makes certain managerial decisions, they can't be managerial. And the courts basically challenged them on that, sent the case back, and in the Elon case, the NLRB has agreed and has rejected that test in favor of a more simple test, which is to say that if they exercise within the managerial sphere of influence, if they exercise sufficient authority, even if they don't represent a majority of in the decision-making body, call it a faculty senate or call it an academic standards committee, whatever you want, then in fact, they might be managerial. Practically speaking, I don't think the Elon case is surprising. Whether you use the old test that the board had formulated or the new test, these particular faculty members in practice didn't exercise much authority within the institution. So they were deemed in the end eligible to organize. So I'm not sure that this decision is that significant in terms of the new rule. What is significant, however, is that I think it does point us to the same issue we talked about previously. There will likely be a push for organizing. There certainly is with respect to a group that doesn't exercise a lot of authority within the shared governance model, a real chance that they are going to be deemed non-managerial and therefore eligible to organize. And I think we're going to continue to struggle with how these standards apply to the full-time tenure and tenure track faculty. Where that line is and how the board is going to apply it is going to continue to be a challenge for the board and, but frankly, for our clients, for the institutions.
Thanks, Pete. So I'm going to throw this out to either of you who want to answer it. Maybe explain to our audience a little bit about the makeup of the board and how that membership is likely to change over the next few years. I think it's pretty well known that Biden is considered a labor union friendly president. He's been referred to as the labor president. We're at the beginning of his term, obviously. So talk a little bit about how the board is expected to change during the Biden administration and what that may mean in terms of decisions impacting our higher education institutions on the labor front.
So, excellent question, Susan. As I had mentioned previously, the board historically, there's a practice that the incumbent president will appoint a majority of the board. It's a five-member board from their own political party. And so, at any particular time, one would expect that President Biden, once his appointments go through, that this board would be a 3-2 Biden-appointed board and therefore have the ability to effectuate his labor policies within the framework of the National Labor Relations Act. The board is constrained to interpret and apply the National Labor Relations Act. And I think that the date where we see a changeover, I believe it's going to be August of this year. I'd have to go back and check for sure. But I think that's when the terms expire that will put the Biden appointees in the majority. Right now, we've got some things happening within the board's administrative offices where Biden has already acted to put some of his appointees in. And that's probably why we saw the rule that Mark mentioned, being pulled back upon. But once we get to a Biden board, I think we expect to see, as you say, probably more pro-labor decisions. And that's where this historical pendulum, the flip-flopping that I've been talking about, I think we'll go back to some of the things in the past that have been promulgated by the Democratic majority board.
And if I could just add to what Pete just said, that I was very interested when I saw the board withdraw the graduate student rulemaking. And as Pete's alluding to, right now the Republicans are still in a 3-2 majority on the board. And you might sit there and wonder, well, why are they doing this? Because they still hold a majority. And the reason, besides what they said publicly in the notice published in the Federal Register, is I think they just realized that the clock's going to run out on them in terms of finalizing the rulemaking. They won't have a majority by the time this would go through. So I think rather than continue to spend time on this process, which can be very time consuming for the board members to try to make rulemaking go through, there must have been a calculus that maybe we can do more for the positions that we advocate, says the Republican majority, by continuing to process cases and issue decisions. So I think that's got to be underneath what's going on there. And also to echo what Pete was saying, I do think that, you know, the Elon case will, while not dramatically changing the standard, will continue to encourage unionization efforts by, in this case, the non-tenured track faculty. But what's really interesting, because the prior standard, which what the board overruled in the Elon case, was a 2014 case called Pacific Lutheran. And in the Pacific Lutheran case, the board had required essentially a supermajority for the adjunct professors to constitute a supermajority on these governance bodies in order to assess this managerial status. And the board here in Elon said, no, we're not going to look at that supermajority status anymore. We're going to look at this more specifically just in terms of whether the adjunct professors have the ability to be involved in kind of the governance of the university. And I think that's going to be a very fact-intensive, frankly, litigation-heavy type of approach, because every time one of these petitions gets filed, there's going to be an opportunity for the college or university, if it so chooses, to litigate whether or not the adjuncts are truly involved in the governance of the university. It won't be so much of a black and white test, you know, majority or non-majority on the faculty committee. So I think there could be some very, you know, factually intensive, detailed hearings before the board on this issue for lawyers who spend their time representing colleges and universities and labor board matters.
I'm really enjoying hearing both of you weigh in on these issues. We're lucky to have such great experts, and I know our audience is enjoying this too. So we can't have any discussion, right, in the current world unless we talk about COVID, in case people have been under a rock and didn't realize we've been dealing with pandemic situations. It just permeates everything in life. Certainly higher ed hasn't been exempt from that. So while institutions were a year ago figuring out how do we go remote, how do we deal with this pandemic situations, and have been trying to figure out for a year now how you make college age students be socially distanced, which I think maybe there is no answer to that, there are also ramifications in the labor world here for higher ed. So I'd like for you guys to weigh in. Are we starting to see labor demands on this topic in the higher ed realm? We've certainly seen it in manufacturing and other settings. We've seen it on a big scale for places like Amazon and some of our other manufacturing facilities. How is this playing out in higher ed?
Yeah, I'm seeing an incredible amount of attention and effort paid by the unions when it comes to this subject. I'm currently involved in negotiations with a number of universities that I represent for labor matters. And in one instance, the union was seeking, I guess, interim bargaining on COVID-related issues and all the subjects you would think about in terms of what was the university doing to protect the workers who may be working in sensitive areas where they may be, for example, housekeepers who may be cleaning dormitories where the school has quarantined, you know, positive COVID students, issues about sick leave and expanded family medical leave even after the FFCRA mandatory requirements expired at the end of last year. So I've seen a tremendous push by the unions to get to the bargaining table to try to resolve those issues. I also have been involved in just routine every 3 years successor bargaining with a couple of universities. And the unions have essentially, I'm not saying by committee and unfair labor practice or anything like that, but they've essentially insisted on starting negotiations on COVID-related matters and trying to get that resolved now because the issue is so timely, and even trying to reach some type of, let's say, COVID side letter or side letter on COVID-related issues before turning to the usual subjects of collective bargaining. So I can tell you right now, I'm involved in, I think, 3 or 4 active negotiations on behalf of university clients. And each one of them, we are focusing on COVID, and I haven't even gotten to the other issues at the table yet.
Wow. Pete, are you seeing some of the same things in your practice?
I am. Sort of taking off of Mark's point, another thing that I've seen is people saying, we'd rather focus on the COVID issues, so let's do a rollover on the underlying contract. There's a lot of uncertainty out there. You don't know whether you're going to have students. You don't know whether you're going to have to, not have full tuition, or, you know, whether there's going to be issues associated with that, whether people won't come. How about we do a rollover? We don't want to accept contract terms from the union's perspective. We don't want to accept contract terms that ultimately we regret. On the other hand, you're saying right now that the uncertainty is going to prevent you from doing anything creative or significant on the wage front, or, you know, perhaps you've got concerns about benefit issues. Let's do a rollover and we'll figure it out when there's less uncertainty. Of course, if you are going to do a rollover, there is the, yeah, let's do a rollover, but how about we talk about these, you know, three issues? And so some rollovers are not really rollovers. The second thing that I just wanted to, you know, sort of make mention of, and I think this qualifies as a trend, at least that we're seeing, is that there's a lot of, I'll use the word anger, but it's, you know, it's upset, it's angst, it's a combination of emotions that people are feeling, I think because of COVID in part, in large part, because they're frustrated with the uncertainty and maybe they're scared and you know, they don't necessarily like, you know, that they have to wear a mask or be socially distant or that they can't have fun. Anyway, I'm seeing this at the bargaining table. That, and I think it's because the people are unhappy with how difficult this situation is, that that's another player in the room, oftentimes in bargaining, and that the employer is perhaps the subject of that anger. Maybe it's a little bit misplaced. I mean, I'm not saying that it's not real or that, you know, a lot of people don't feel it or shouldn't feel it, but it seems like it sometimes gets directed in a way that might be a little bit outsized toward the employer in the bargaining process. I'm aware of, you know, a number of places where pretty good contracts have been voted down without the union really seeing it coming. And I think that could be attributable to, you know, sort of the climate we're in. The other thing I guess I would just mention in terms of, you know, certainly all the issues that Mark has talked about, but, you know, I think we're seeing now the questions about vaccination. And again, this is probably side negotiations if you're not in the at the main table. But, you know, a lot of the things that were done initially may have already been bargained under the management rights clause, you know, whether you can do a certain amount of COVID testing or, you know, the questionnaires or things like that. And they may also be issues that you're able to reach a fairly easy side letter with a union on if you do, you know, end up bargaining it. Vaccinations are a little bit different. Because, you know, some people believe very strongly that everyone should be vaccinated and, you know, they would like that in the workplace so they can feel safe, et cetera, et cetera. Some people are very opposed. And so, you know, the unions may be in a very difficult position in terms of trying to, you know, come forth with the sentiment of their members. And I do think that a mandatory vaccination is perhaps less likely to be covered by your existing collective bargaining agreement language, which would then make it a subject that's, you know, open for bargaining.
And just on that last subject that Pete raised, I wanted to comment that one of the colleges I represent here in Maryland became a vaccination site through the state efforts. And there was a lot of, which obviously had nothing to do with the college's relationship with the union per se. That was something that the college wound up doing because of whatever efforts it had through the governor's office here in Maryland. And then it became an issue at the bargaining table because the union was concerned about its members having to do any work at or near, actually, first it was a testing site, then it became a vaccination site. So the union was quite concerned about any of its members. And they represented housekeeping employees or environmental type employees that might have some work in the area, also sworn police officer units who would be doing some work in terms of crowd control and what have you. So the union raised at the table, you know, certain issues about what its members were being asked to do or not asked to do in connection with something that was really, you know, outside of the relationship with the union, just the fact that the college became a testing and then vaccination site. So it led to some interesting discussions at the bargaining table.
Well, it sounds like the takeaway for our institutions that are already have some unionized workforce is COVID is going to be top of mind as it relates to working conditions and relates to bargaining issues. Gentlemen, tell me what you think. What's the takeaway for our folks that have sectors that are not unionized? I mean, we started today's conversation with the withdrawal of the proposed rulemaking, which opens the door to unionization of graduate and graduate students. What should our folks, other than being aware of what's going on, what should our folks in higher ed be doing now proactively if they don't currently have unionized workforces to be prepared for what's likely to be coming in the future under this administration?
So very good question. I mean, I think to me, it starts with good labor relations. I mean, it sounds simple, but it's tried and true that if you've got a good relationship with whatever group of employees or potential employees we're talking about, there's a lot less need for them to turn to a third party for representation. I recognize that in these times, that may be challenging. And especially if there is this angst and, you know, anger that's out there that is not of necessarily of the employer's making. But, you know, if people can be treated with respect and dignity and communications can be strong and the terms and conditions of employment can be good, I think you're a lot less likely to have, you know, traction from an outside union coming in trying to organize your groups. Mark, I don't know if you've got other thoughts on that or.
Well, one thing I'll say about the environment at colleges and universities, which I think makes it challenging sometimes for those institutions to try to remain union-free in certain areas of their workforce, is that they often have unionized segments of their population. So whether the university has a sworn police officer unit, for example, which typically with the strength of the FOP throughout the country, that's a likely unit to be organized. Sometimes some of the environmental groups, the maintenance housekeeping groups also are more likely targets for unionization efforts. I think it becomes, you know, quite a challenge for any employer, in this case, obviously institutions of higher education, to be able to, you know, explain to other employees why remaining union free is in both in their interest as well as the university's interest. So I think, Susan, to the question you asked, I think it's going to be a challenge for everybody because that's just a fact of life in this segment. And then as you were talking about the COVID, what really enables unions to organize? I think it's concern, lack of security, being worried about the future. And those are all things that everybody is feeling because of COVID for entirely natural reasons. And look, nobody knows for sure how it's going to play out. We're watching what happens with, you know, large parts of the country become vaccinated, but there's also concerns about additional surges. We see the country reopening in many states throughout the country, but it still remains a work in progress. So I think as long as we have this overall uncertainty about this subject, I think that's going to give a voice to employees who feel like maybe they're not getting heard or having their concerns, you know, heard by universities to turn to the unions. And, you know, just on that last point, I'm sure for our higher education clients, it's very difficult to manage the return to work. It's not just a bunch of students coming to your local, you know, elementary school. We've got all the issues with the university where students live and reside on campus, the Division I athletics, and all the other, you know, particularities of this environment. So I think there is a lot of concern, and I think the universities are rightfully very focused on, you know, trying to get their campuses back up and maybe returning to more of a semblance of normalcy come next fall. So in this vacuum, sometimes, you know, union can step in and be an ear for the employees who may feel like they don't have the administration. So to Pete's point, it's just good employee relations. I mean, it is very basic, but that's what it is.
We're seeing an interesting confluence of events here. In the midst of a pandemic, we have some shifts here legally, especially in the labor world, that they're going to have interesting impacts on our higher ed clients. Pete and Mark, you guys have been fabulous today. Thank you for all of the great insights you have provided on this important topic. I know our listeners are going to have enjoyed it as much as I have being able to listen to it today. If you'd like to connect with Pete, Mark, or any of our lawyers around the world, please search for them on the ELA website at ela.law by going to the big Find a Lawyer widget in the center of the page where you can sign up to receive invitations to our upcoming webinars, download white papers and on-demand content from our online library, or access the ELA's exclusive Global Employer Handbook. You've been listening to Employment Matters, a podcast brought to you by the Employment Law Alliance, the world's largest network of labor and employment lawyers from the best law firms around the globe. I'm Susan Deniker. Thanks so much for listening.